Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
Welcome back to Whiskey Congress, the rare midweek show. So
yes, indeed. Because I mean, per usual, there's just a ton of stuff to keep up with. It's only Tuesday, so figured we might as well
get back at it.
Yeah.
So we left the last show talking about Frederica Wilson and LaDavid Johnson's widow, and.
Yeah, so LaDavid Johnson's widow came out early this week, I believe that was yesterday, and confirmed what Frederica Wilson had said, that, Trump said he knew what he was getting into, it's still sad, and essentially gave just a callous phone call, didn't show a lot of empathy, and, my criticism was more on Frederica Wilson for putting it out there. It seemed like she was making it more about her. Now, to her credit, I guess, to a degree, there is the fact that Trump really sounds like he didn't handle this well. And that's not a surprise to anybody.
Right.
And the widow came out and confirmed, the call on, one of the morning shows or multiple morning shows. And it when you contrast it with the way Barack Obama handled these situations, I think when you just contrast Obama and Trump, Obama's going to win that every time, right? He knew how to speak to people. He did care what they think. And in those situations, that's really, really valuable. Trump doesn't have that same side. So it's not a surprise to me that in this situation, talking to a woman named Maisha, as opposed to, Susan, that this he gives this sort of, I made the call. I mean, so she should be happy that I made the call sort of deal, and then you can actually contrast this with, remember when he gave his first, it was right after the inauguration, but you have the widow of the soldier who had died, and I can't remember if it was a State of the Union.
No,
but you know what I'm talking about,
right?
Right, and the woman was there, the soldier who had died.
I believe it was in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, right? And it was a different feel, a different vibe. So I could point to. And I think I did sort of indirectly that, he's talking to a widow of a black soldier, a black woman and a widow of a black soldier, as opposed to, the shining example that we always see, the white soldier, the Pat Tillman types and their wives and their strong wives and everything else. And in this sort of situation, it's just like, well, your husband knew what he was getting into. Sucks for you. But I'm sure you're glad I called. So we'll talk to you later.
It comes off... To what degree Trump is putting race into it, and to what degree it just is how he is when it comes to...
I don't think he's putting race into it. I just think that he sees two things. You put two things in front of him, and he looks at the one, right? And they're very, very separate, right? So he looks at the one and sees, oh, this is what we want to prop up. He sees an opportunity and says, okay. So he does. The white soldier and the white wife... blonde hair, and she's very strong, and we're going to put her on the forefront. That's an opportunity.
And he also did that, right, at a speech where he is the center of attention.
Right. So she gets the big applause, but then he talks about all the applause, and it's kind of like, well, it's applause because, I gave her the attention. And in this situation, he doesn't see that opportunity. And I think he's not saying, because you are black, I'm going to ignore you. It's just that in his mind... He doesn't see the same opportunity, and so he just dismisses it.
Well, but I think also this was not something he expected to become get exposed to the public spotlight, right? Mm-hmm. He thought, I made the call, had a great conversation with this wonderful woman, the end, and it just so happens that in the car with her is Frederica Wilson, who waves a flag and says, whoa,
yeah.
let me tell you what I wanted to do. I wanted to rip the phone out of her hands and tell you what a jerk you were being. So then it goes into time to deny, time to defend. And we've got the mess we got now.
Which it would never happen with him. All could have pretty much been resolved if he says, you know what, in the heat of the moment, in the midst of what was going on, I should have taken more time to be more empathetic. I'm sorry. You send a nice note or what have you. You have her to the White House and you make up for it. Or you at least extend the offer and invitation before. And that's how you do damage control.
Trump, but in order to do damage control, you need to admit you did something wrong.
You need to admit that you damaged something, right? That something is damaged in the first place. And that's where Trump, in theory, seemingly gets himself into trouble. But he just doesn't care. Right? I mean, he just doesn't care. Like, he starts a fire and he says, well, fuck it, let it burn. You know, and I'll put more gas on it and then eventually it'll burn itself out and then I'll move on to the next building and set that one on fire too. And that's his pattern, right? Like, he's not standing there with a fire extinguisher. He's standing there with a hose filled with additional gasoline. I guess to take from this is... Again, the condolences to the widow and the children. This situation is probably made so much worse because of the spotlight. You know, she's trying to deal with the fact that her husband, you know, isn't going to come home and walk through the door. The kids don't have a father. And, you know, she's, you know, giving press conferences. I'm sure people are calling, you know, nonstop trying to get a quote of some sort. So, you know. Your heart goes out for her having to deal with this in this way. And I think you and I should shift the spotlight a little bit. And some other people have asked the question, what happened? Like that caught, like, right. How did he end up dead? Why were we even there? Did you know, James, that the U.S. military is active in 175 countries in the world?
I did not know it was that many.
Okay. Do you know how many countries we have?
It's around 200.
195.
Okay.
So
who are the 20?
Right?
We're not in North Korea.
Right, we're not in North Korea. I don't think we're in Russia.
I wonder.
We're probably not in Switzerland.
Maybe not. Maybe their neutrality plan keeps them up. But anyway, try to name the 20 countries we're not in.
It's easier to name, you know, once you look at a map, it'd probably be easier to name the 20 that we're not in as opposed to the 175 that we are in. And so what's interesting, though, is the reason why we had U.S. troops in Niger. Now, I don't know if this is a specific reason why they were there. But the United States, the U.S. military is building a drone base in Niger.
Which you mentioned to me prior to the show, and I had no idea about, but I was asking the question, why were we there in the first place? Because we had no knowledge of military activity.
And so I don't know if that's specifically why they were there, but I do know the U.S. military is building a $100 million drone facility in Niger. And I have to make sure I'm saying that right, because I think I said Niger earlier. But it begs the question, right, of U.S. military activity in Africa and really all over the world, right? Like, we're in 175 countries. Why? We have some ridiculous number of missions. Like, I think close to 600 or 700 active U.S. missions going on in Africa right now under the guise of, you know, fighting Al-Qaeda, fighting ISIS, fighting Boko Haram, fighting... You know, all these different terrorist organizations, but some of it just doesn't add up, right?
It makes sense we'd want a drone base in that area because if we wanted to get a quick strike based on intelligence, sending a drone from an aircraft carrier or from space or from the U.S. takes a long time.
Right.
If you're going from Niger to Somalia, name it.
Right.
They're right there.
Right. You know, that to me is interesting, and you know, there's a greater question, I guess, that you could go into about overall U.S. interest, right? I mean, is it all just peacekeeping? Is it all just, hey, we're just looking out for you guys, right? But when you look at Africa, it is, there's gold, There are diamonds. There is oil. There's this mineral called coltan, right? Which is, it's got a longer name and it's two words, and it's this weird mineral that's only, well, it's not only found, but there's a large deposit of it in the Congo, right? Where I guess we're running missions in the Congo as well. So, you know, they have all these resources there, and we have, you know, 600 to 700 active military missions in that country right now,
in that continent,
or on that continent, as a whole. And so it's not hard to draw the conclusion that part of that has to be, or may be, or could be
financially motivated.
Could be financially motivated, right? It's used in cell phones all across the world, right? And I guess it's getting harder and harder to mine. And so, you know, there's a large deposit of it in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So, and yet we have a lot of military in the Congo. I don't think...
Coincidence, I think not.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of coincidences with that. You know, we have a lot of troops in these countries where there are a lot of minerals. Well, some will say that's where your terrorist organizations and your warlords, they're focused there because they recognize what's there.
Sure.
And so
this is conflict diamonds just in your cell phone.
Right. I mean, and so there's other things of value there. And I guess my last question on this, right, because I've just been reading a lot and listening a lot to a lot of different type of conversations, and all these different questions have been floated around, have been floating all around in my head. Why Africa has all these different resources.
Right.
Right. But yet their dollar, you know, it takes 5,000 of their dollars to get to one of ours. And you have to wonder at some point in time, like, what it would take for the continent as a whole and all the individual countries to realize the power that they could hold. And a lot of that goes back to warlords and terrorists and us fighting and protecting them and everything else. But I mean, it's amazing when you think about everything that encompasses that continent. And, you know, for people who say, you know, the United States is this war hungry country and they're seeking to influence the entire world with their beliefs and mindset, you think about what's going on in Africa, and it's hard to kind of dispute that.
Hard to separate the two. Well, first of all, wasn't this the whole point of the Stephen K. Bannon influence, that we were going to get out of these conflicts and out of these types of things and focus on America first?
Right.
But that doesn't mean this isn't really America first, because if they've got something we need,
right,
it wouldn't be the first time that our financial interests motivated the use of military force. We'll get...
That is what Trump ran on, was this national populist movement, America first. We're going to pull our troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan. We never should have went to Iraq. Like, Trump is a huge guy. You know, Hillary voted for Iraq, and we never should have went there. I thought that was a mistake. It was a big mistake by George W. Bush. And, you know, he still says that on occasion when
he's not wrong about that.
Right, and he's not. And yet, he talked about adding troops to Afghanistan and Iraq. We're still obviously all over the world. We're not pulling back at all. And so, you know, that whole thing that he ran on reducing our footprint from a military standpoint, retracting it in so we could, you know, build it up and everything else, none of that is... Now, it's only been 8 months.
Right.
It's only been 8 months, but, I mean, we haven't seen a reduction in anything. We've only seen, you know, we've only talked about sending even more troops out.
And adding $600 billion to a military budget that is already greater than the next 7 or 8 nations in the world combined.
Right.
So, at one time it was 19. We had put more money in the next 19. I guess we're going to try to get back there. Yes, all right. That is very, very interesting to me, and getting way too little news coverage is, why are we in Niger? Why was this mission there? Like I said, the drone base getting built there makes sense. I think Niger is a relatively stable country, at least by African standards. I mean, the problem with Africa, I don't know a lot, but I know they're not Somalia, Ethiopia. I mean, and a lot of Central Africa is pretty you know, not well defined in terms of what the government controls and doesn't control. Here's the thing.
I don't think we actually know. In reality, how much does the media cover what goes on in Africa, right? Only when something really, really terrible happens.
Yep.
But there's atrocities that happen there every day. And then there's places there that are beautiful and amazing that aren't being touched and ripped apart by violence. But we don't know. Media doesn't cover it. You don't know dick about Africa other than what you see on the Discovery Channel. And I'm not attacking
No. I do have one little bit of insight that my cousin's wife is Kenyan, and they've gone to Kenya multiple times, and her parents live there. So I have gotten to, you know, hear their stories and hear whatever. And even Kenya, which I think is one of the most stable democratic countries in Africa, has had a major terror attack. My cousin's wife, who was the one who provided us with Rodan Field stuff, mm-hmm. Her parents were attacked in their home. You know, there was civil unrest just outside of I'm drawing a blank on the capital of Kenya. Fuck. But you know, just outside of Nairobi, I think Nairobi. So, I mean, that's the most stable country, and they've got rebel activity. I mean, as fucked up as things are in America, you know, we don't have organized forces attempting to. Obviously, we don't have organized forces attempting to overthrow the government. And I turned on Alex Jones, and maybe I'm wrong about that. But
I guess my point is that as a whole, the American people don't know anything about Africa. We don't know a lot about many places outside of the U.S. We do kind of live in a bubble. You know, social media, the internet has helped expand our minds and thoughts on that. And you know, the ability to travel. And, you know, vaccinations and things like that allow people to travel more so they do get better insight. But a majority of the people that we interact with on a day-to-day basis really have no idea what's going on in a lot of different countries, even in Europe. But we know a lot more about Europe because it's taught in the schools. Africa, it's the biggest continent. Here's the number of countries. If you memorize them, great. If not, it's not that big of a deal. And, oh, yeah, that's where the slaves came from, and let's fast forward.
And South Africa used to have a really bad policy that they got rid of 25 years ago.
Right. And that's kind of, that's how it's taught, and that's how, and I guess my point is, you know, as a black person, I feel like I should know more about it. I should, right? Like, I'll be the first to tell you, I'm not moving there. I'm not going there. That's not.
Would you? Would you want to visit?
Yeah, I'll go.
Okay.
I'll go. I'll visit. I'm coming back though. Like my shit is here, and this is where I'm from. And you're not gonna sell me on the whole back to Africa thing. I've never been there, so I can't go back.
You mentioned on the show that you can trace your family back to Louisiana.
Right. Moving there either. it's a great time from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, but you know. And I'll just blame the weather on that one. But, you know, I have no... I want to know more about the continent. It would be nice to know, to be able to track where specifically I'm from so I could say, okay, this gives me an idea. And learn about the people and learn about the culture. All that is something that I should do and will do over time. But I think that it's just important to know if you're going to think critically about global issues, then you probably should know about the biggest landmass, you know, in the world. And you should know about the history of that continent because Europe, the United States, Canada, South America, Central America, China, the Middle East, they all have a connection to Africa, right? Either they went there and...
Either they colonized it and fucked it up years ago.
Right, or someone from there came and colonized and you know, took them over. I mean, there's so much that goes on there, right? I mean, you know, we talk about countries like, you know, we talk about Libya. How many people even know that Libya is actually in Africa? Right, I mean, there's a lot of people who they assume it's just a part of the Middle East, and I mean, there's people from Egypt who, you know, like people don't draw the connection that Egypt is a part of Africa. You know, I mean, They kind of do, but they don't, right?
Right, I mean, because of they're on the Mediterranean Sea, so they're easily accessible to Europe. I mean, by boat, you know, short boat ride, you can be in, you know, one or the other. I mean, shit, in ancient Roman times, Egypt and Rome were interacting, sometimes good, sometimes bad.
Right.
But, I mean, that was when I don't know that there were even sailboats. It was just boats and oars.
Right.
So
we about to row this.
Yeah, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there were sails by then, back then, but I mean, we're talking a long fucking time ago.
I can't tell you the date of the invention of the sail. I feel like that came along relatively early in boat life.
But I don't. Let's not go down this road. So let's we just acknowledged our lack of
nautical knowledge.
Nautical knowledge, or lack of really international knowledge when it comes to Africa, and we got enough going on.
But that's important, though.
No, I agree.
It's important. I mean, because it's the reason why it's important is that I have to acknowledge it, right? And I think that it's important that you acknowledge it, right? I mean, and when you acknowledge that, you don't really know a lot about it. Like, yeah, your brothers, sisters, cousins, wife is from Kenya, and all that other stuff. And that's an anecdotal story.
Well,
you don't.
But my cousin's been there, is my point.
But you don't know, you really don't know anything about it, right? As a whole, right? I mean, you could probably tell me a lot more about, you know, and you probably tell me a lot more about Poland and Italy than you can about Kenya. Anything in Africa or Kenya, sure. Or anything else, and which is fine because you're Polish and Italian. But, you know, as a whole, but you could also probably tell me a lot more about Ireland, right? You're not Irish. You know, you could probably tell me a lot more about, you know, a number of different countries on the continent and, you know, a lot just kind of like you, I mean,
sure.
You've been to India. I was going to say India, but you've been there, I think, multiple times.
Just once
for an
extended long, yeah, it was a long time.
So, I mean, that's a little bit different, but I just think it's important that we kind of think about that when we're talking about these global issues. And then also, you know, when you get into the roots of systemic racism, right, that we talked about in the past. And part of that is you don't know anything about that continent. And I don't think that is an accident. Right. I mean, I just think that we don't learn a lot about it. They don't teach a lot about it in schools. A lot of the history gets whitewashed. And there's a lot of brutal history there that just never really comes out. And the more you dig, the more fucked up you realize.
I mean, sadly, probably my biggest piece of like insight into Africa and its history and the history of violence are movies. I've seen Blood Diamond. I've seen Hotel Rwanda.
Right.
And I think, you know, the main character, there have been some things said about him being glorified in the movie, whatever. But I think the overall military, and Black Hawk Down, too. Got to see
right.
a lot of, but it was still movies, but, you know, parts of what they depict are clearly real and brutal, and they do get
right.
relatively little attention.
Those are real stories. Even the story of Nelson Mandela, you know, which was one of the stories that came out of Africa that people have a fair amount of knowledge about. But you're right. Like that's how. And there's a lot of things we learn about through cinema. There's nothing wrong with that. But
you can't take it as gospel when
right,
it comes from cinema.
It's not gospel. It's only surface level. And I think with a lot of other countries. In a lot of other, you know, cultures, we just get a little bit more information, right?
Oh, no, a lot more. You're right. And we don't, I mean, when something horrific happens, like the Kenyan Mall attack, we get news about that because it's a terror attack and if it bleeds, it leads.
Right.
But, you're right. I mean, I don't know a whole lot. You don't know a whole lot. And we're probably well into the upper half. I mean, maybe not top 10% of educated on these things, but we're certainly.
Right. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of people who, you know, do study this stuff.
I wonder what the best source of information, like if I wanted to get African news, if I wanted to see the news from Niger, from Nairobi, which is the capital of Kenya, that did finally click for sure in my head, so I feel better now.
That's a great question. You know, I try to watch the BBC. I try to watch Al Jazeera.
Al Jazeera is probably one of your better.
It'll probably because they're in the region, but in terms of, I mean, because I don't think people realize how big of a continent Africa is. So you know, you kind of have to pick where you want to get news from and go. Like, I don't know if there's a central source. You know, there could be, but I mean, it's just such a massive place.
When you think about it, it's distinctly bigger than North America. And if you try to talk about North Americans in a lump group, good luck with that. Right. So you talk about Toronto at the same time you're talking about Lubbock, Texas, at the same time you're talking about Mexico City, at the same time you're talking about El Salvador, right? All those things fall into one continent. Africa is a bigger continent. And like we just talked about, you got the Mediterranean area, which is essentially connected to Europe. Then you go to down to South Africa, and it's completely in its own world.
Yeah, it's right. So in terms of where do you find news?
I mean, and you can bet the Brits, the French, or the Dutch fucked it up at one point.
Yes. Don't leave the Asians out now. Someone from China got into there as well.
Okay.
They don't get the slap on the wrist they should for their meddling.
For their. All right, let's go domestic because we've got some political news. We've Jeff Flake says he's not going to run for re-election. I'm not a fan of Jeff Flake. His name makes the jokes way too easy, so I won't bother. But his decision not to run for Senate to me sounds like he wants to run for president. He's a pretty staunch right-wing traditional Republican. He's been very critical of Trump. I can see him saying, I'm stepping out of the day-to-day job of being a senator and going after Trump in 2020 from the Republican side.
Doesn't surprise me. I didn't get there today with that thought.
Okay.
But it makes sense. So, you know, and it definitely makes sense because I think there will be competition. There will be those that run against Trump from his own party in this next presidential go-round. So the idea that he's stepping back and saying, I'm not going to seek re-election in 2018 because he wants to make a run at president makes sense. I can definitely get there with you on that.
Or it could be wrong. It could be some scandal that's about to blow up.
Well, I don't know if it's as much a scandal. What I do know is that he was facing some pretty heavy pressure he's facing somebody's running against him. It's a woman. I can't think of her name right now. But she's got backing from that Breitbart Steve Bannon group, and she falls right in line with Trump and, you know, heavy on border security and immigration, tax reform, tax cuts, build a wall, all those things. Like, she basically just regurgitates what Trump says word for word. And so, you know, and she's got a lot of support to the point where she will probably in the primary overtake him. Now the question is, will she get enough support to win? And I,
well, if you're running in Arizona, though, your primary is your election.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there have been congressmen and senators from Arizona that were Democrats, I'm sure, but right now I think it is so dyed in the wool Republican that you're not. If you win the Republican primary,
you're probably
going to be a senator.
So, but I think I don't know if it's as much as that he wants to run for president, or does he just not want to take the loss in the primary, knowing the implications, right? I mean, it's just like, you know, I think he's choosing to step away on his own terms with air quotes, as opposed to taking the loss and kind of having to.
He's a relatively young guy, right? I mean, he's.
Yeah, and so, which is why what you're saying makes sense. I don't know if he actually has those aspirations, because I don't know if he realistically has a chance or shot at president. You know, I mean, because I think there are a lot of people who don't like Trump, who don't like the person that's basically primarying him. But at the same time, they don't really like him enough to where he could get any sort of backing or momentum or support. But, I mean, these guys have egos. So, you know, maybe he does think he can, you know, he can make a run for it. I don't know. I think he's stepping away because he doesn't want to take an L in the primary, and he's using it because here's the other thing. I mean, well, see, now you got me thinking, because he, you know, he came out today and was very anti-Trump, and he, you know, essentially called out Trump for the rhetoric. He called him out and, you know, things like he's not saying it like it is. He's just being, you know, crass and, you know, just really kind of everything that people are saying, the reasons why they like Trump, you know, which has nothing to do with legislation or governing, just personality and, you know, character. And Flake came out and attacked that today pretty aggressively, you know, basically saying he had his children and grandchildren to answer to, and he wasn't going to stand for it anymore. And so
that sounds like someone who's running for presidency.
I'm not disagreeing.
No.
But that, I also think that this guy knows that he's about to lose in the primary, so that has something to do with it too. And if you can't win a primary as senator, I'm not sure you
can win a. Well, I mean, there have been plenty of cases where someone didn't, though, right? Lieberman years ago lost his primary, ran as an independent, left the Democratic Party, and won as an independent. So some of these guys can win on the big stage.
What?
Senator of Connecticut.
Oh, Lieberman. Yeah. But he's running for senator, not president.
True. But I'm saying in terms of getting primaried in Arizona, some of these guys can literally lose a primary and win a general election, because when the insanity of a primary isn't in front of them, they don't do as badly. But all right, that's speculation. If it shows up again down the road, you heard it here first on Whiskey Congress. Other senators not seeking re-election. I'm not a fan of Bob Corker. Politically, I don't like... Well, I wasn't a fan of Bob Corker. When he made the comment about the White House being a poorly run
adult daycare,
that amused me, and I gave him credit, because unlike John McCain, I don't think Bob Corker has a history of calling attention to things and bucking the system, right? And now he gave an interview today where he really pissed me off, but entertained me, because he was basically called the president a liar. He said, this guy is telling things that are not true, that he knows are not true. Then he said, but I won't say the L word. And I'm thinking, fuck you, say the L word. Say liar, you pansy. You know, it's if you can't say it out loud when you're saying it,
well,
you're being a...
But the reason he's doing that is because...
He's more dignified than me.
No, it's not about dignity. It's about how, if you call Trump a liar, what is Trump going to do? He's going to focus on the fact that you called him a liar. He's going to put the attention and the focus on the word liar, right? And then he's going to send out Sarah Huckabee Sanders out there to say, I just think it's so disrespectful for you to call the president a liar. That this is something that you should not do in this form of government that we have, and I just can't believe that he did that. Next question. So,
all right, that was not bad at all. I have to keep.
I think that it was strategic. That I don't think he was actually being a Nancy boy about it. I just think that he was kind of taking away some of the president's ammo before.
Maybe.
And I know that's what he was doing. And he was and by saying I'm not going to say the L word, I think that was taunting the president. So I wouldn't go the, you know, fuck you Bob Corker route for that, but I would go fuck you Bob Corker for something else. But you finish up your...
I'm amazed at how mainstream of a Republican is so openly calling the sitting president from his party a dishonest, dishonorable person, and that he's running an adult daycare, or is being run by an adult daycare. So that is way different than, you know, lots of people on the right said some really negative shit about Obama. Lots of people on the left, lots of people on the left have said bad things about Bush and reverse on Clinton. But for someone of their own party to be this aggressive about something less than 1 year into presidency in their party is news to me.
It is. And part of my issue where I kind of give the middle finger to both Jeff Flake and Bob Corker is that they're both saying, this is all coming out now. that they're not, now that they know that they're not seeking re-election, right? So right. Flake and Corker both are seeking re-election, and so now, you know, they're going to get indignant, right? They're going to stand up and say everything and stand for the little guy, and they're going to, you know, fight Trump tooth and nail, right? Because they're not seeking re-election.
Right.
And so while somebody needs to say it, and it's good that it's coming out of his own party, when from this position, you can fight him, and they will be able to. I think that those two plus McCain will definitely provide. They can be a real thorn in the Trump administration's side because, you know, if you know they don't vote for the budget, it doesn't get through. If they don't vote, you know, and if the budget doesn't get through, tax reform doesn't go through. McCain already screwed him over on healthcare. You know, so these sort of like they can definitely screw with him for the next, you know, what, year and a half? Year?
Well, and, you know, we've said many times on the show, and I stand by it, that the Republic, everything's been so party line for such a long time that if you had control of both houses and the White House, you had pretty much, I won't quite say free reign, but pretty close to it, right? I mean, it came down to that when the Republicans, you know, waived the need to get 60 votes in the Senate, made it a simple majority, and then they were still unable to get, you know, health care reform under those conditions. You know, they've got a 52-48 lead in the Senate and a much bigger one in the House. But the House is going to face, you know, a lot of turnover, whereas the Senate doesn't change as quickly. It's every 6 years their terms come up, and this coming 2018 election is very heavily in the, most of the incumbents are Democrats. So the fact that these guys are doing this, they've essentially stalemated the government on their own. And yeah, they're doing it now with Flake and with Corker and McCain having done what he's doing. And look, I like John McCain. I've said that out loud many times on the show and to you in other conversations, but he's not going to be around a lot longer. I mean, he's an old guy who's facing some pretty serious health issues. Now, he's a stubborn, gritty guy who will not go away without a substantial fight. But, you know, we can't rely on John McCain to carry the torch of sane Republican for forever.
True. And so I guess to a certain degree, if Corker and Flake and McCain and
Leslie Graham...
I don't even know. I don't know if Leslie Graham knows what day it is from day to day.
If John McCain knows what day it is, Leslie Graham knows what day it is.
Fair. But like you said, you know, Leslie is maybe around a little bit longer than John. And I don't have a lot of faith in Leslie Graham. I really don't. He blows with the wind and has been very inconsistent over the last 6 months. You know, I mean, he's outraged by Trump, and then he says Trump is a reasonable guy, and then he's outraged by Trump again, and then Trump's a pretty reasonable guy. So I don't really have a lot of faith in Lindsey Graham. He's kind of a wild card, but I think he'll fold.
See, I think he's literally a puppet of John McCain. I think he respects John McCain a lot and will do whatever. I think John McCain pretty much guides where Lindsey Graham is going. Maybe I'm overstating it.
Yeah, I think you're overstating that and oversimplifying that based off of. I mean, it was the wasn't it the Graham and.
Well, that's right. No, it was Graham and
the other guy who introduced the healthcare bill, and you know.
McCain was the one to shut it down. So right. Yeah, you're right.
So I mean, I just think if you were a puppet of McCain,
that's true.
Graham Alexander.
No, it's a guy from Louisiana. Former physician, and I'm not going to come up with it.
Yeah, I'm not.
All right.
But anyway, I don't necessarily rely on Lindsey Graham, but I do think that Flake and Corker and McCain, there's a woman as well, maybe.
From Maine.
Susan Collins?
Yes.
They can cause enough problems to cause a stalemate. And if you don't get a budget, or you know the budget doesn't end up.
Graham Cassidy was the
Cassidy. Budget. That's what it was. Cassidy. How do I forget that? Oh, yeah. Anyway, there was a rapper, Cassidy, but I couldn't think of the song, and then I attributed the wrong song to him. So anyway, that takes us down the wrong road.
That was okay.
Listen,
this is a relatively low whiskey night, and we're doing this.
I use hip hop to help me map things, right? Like I remember, if I can remember the song, then I can remember like the time. You know, things happen. I use hip hop and sports to help me like remember when I was. You know,
I do that with sports and movies for me.
So, you know, moving on to, you know, talking about things where Flake and Corker and McCain and those guys can kind of screw Trump over is with the budget, right? The budget and tax reform. Tax reform is the key, but you don't get to tax reform unless you get a budget. And so the Senate Budget Committee, they put out kind of a rough outline of what they want the budget to look like. And then you've also, with that, got a rough outline of what tax reform may look like. Not a lot of details, but one of the things that come out of it was that they wanted to introduce 401k caps, right, to your...
We talked about this before the show, but go ahead and explain how important that is. Or I will. It's up to you.
Well, so without boring people with explaining the 401k and the history of it, most people out there listening to us, you have a 401k or you have a pension or you understand what they are. Right, and depending on where you're at financially, dictates how much money you put into it. Right now, the most you can put into a 401k, if you're under the age of, I believe, 50 or 60. I don't know the age because I'm not there yet, so
right.
I don't care. But right now, the most I can put into my 401k is $1,800.
$18,000.
Or $18,000. Sorry. Pre-tax.
Right. Right.
So that first $18,000 that I put in per year goes in pre-tax. Now, the benefit of that is that money goes in whole as $18,000.
Right.
And then it goes into your 401k, you invest with it, and then if you invest wisely and, you know, you don't take too many risks and you don't take too many hits, then that money, in theory, should grow. You know, depending on how you do it up, the percentage varies.
And when you retire, that money is waiting for you. And when you take it out, it will get taxed. But at that point, your income is lower and has grown.
So that's how that replaces pensions, which before, you know, you worked, money was taken out. It was put into an account for you. And that money was matched to a certain percentage by the company that you worked for. And it built and it built and it built. And then that was the money that you were used to retire.
Which, in a world of our parents' generation, lots of people worked for the same company for 30 years, and that was kind of the expectation or the standard. I mean,
right.
You know, for me, that isn't how things go. But you know, I mean, I grew up in Buffalo. You know, the steel companies had pension plans, and if you worked 30 years in the mill, you got to retire and live the good life and do whatever. And the same was true of, you know, every major industrial city in the country, and that's not how it is today.
Right. I'm from Youngstown, same thing. A lot of those pensions ended up getting mismanaged, and they realized that they were going to run out of money, you know, before a lot of the people were going to be able to use them. So, you had people who were thinking that their pension was going to take care of them, you know, through their golden years, and it was, you know, blatantly evident that not only is it not going to be enough, but you're still going to have to work. You know, once you're past the age of retirement. So a lot of different industries and a lot of different corporations were bailed out with the 401k, with introducing the 401k into the whole financial scheme.
It just changes the structure by which you did that in your life.
Right. And so instead of it being, you know, managed and taken care of by the company that you work for, now they kind of put it in your hands. And you save the money. Maybe your company matches to a certain percentage. Maybe they don't. But you invest it, and that's how you save, right? And now what they're saying is that $18,000 that you can, you know, not most people don't put that much in. But let's just say you did, right? Now what they're saying is the most that you could put in, and this isn't anything other than a proposal, but they want to change it so that the most that you can put it in, that you can put in pre-tax, is $2,500. And I didn't say that wrong. $2,500 down from $18,000.
which means if you try to save $10,000 a year, you're now going to pay tax on $7,500 of that.
Right.
So that's money that's not going to your retirement. It's going straight into...
It's going into government coffers.
Right, yep.
And the reason why they're doing that is because they want to introduce tax cuts, which is going to reduce revenue into the federal government. And so if they reduce money coming in, they have to try to make that up somewhere. And they see a huge gap with these 401k plans. So they say, okay, we'll just get that money back through the way people save for retirement.
And Steve, it has another impact potentially. Because if you tell me, you know, you can put $18,000 a year, if I'm lucky enough in that year, to do that, the angel on my shoulder is saying, put that money away, you'll need it later. If you tell me that money's going to get taxed, I might say, fuck it. I'm not going to save that money. It's getting taxed as if I was going to spend it anyway. So that could, in addition to, this is the ultimate kick the can down the road thing. So you want to stimulate the consumer economy in the short term, tell people there's no tax incentive to saving for your retirement, and maybe instead of saying, okay, I'm going to put 10 grand a year into this, I'm going to put 2,500, the maximum allowed to go in pre-tax, and then the rest, I'll tell myself I'm going to save it, but will I?
No. I mean, you know, most people won't, because, I mean, we look at even now with the way the 401ks are set up, you know, a lot of people have them, but how much do they really know about their 401k? How much money do they have going in? Maybe 3% of their income. If the average income is $60,000, then how much is that really going in? It's not anywhere near that $18,000
cap. Right.
So, I mean, people are already doing an average to mediocre job of saving for money. They're saving for their future.
And there's a lot of people out there with a ton of credit card debt.
Right, with just, you know, all sorts of debt. So,
and student debt.
Loan debt, credit card debt, all that stuff. And, you know, I can attest to... you know, to the student loan debt and credit card debt as well. So you look at it and you say, okay, well, you know, screw the whole saving thing. If they're just going to tax me on it, I'm going to lose 30% of it anyway, and it's just going to go to the government. I'm not going to see any of that coming back. What's the point of putting it in there, right? I mean, my money's not going to be worth nearly as much down the road. And, you know, and here's the question. Then that $2,500 that went in pre-tax is still going to get taxed on the back end.
Yeah.
Right? It
does remove the incentive to have a 401k.
Right. And I don't know, like, people, obviously your investors and things like that are going to spin it because they're going to still want you to save, so they're going to push you to do it, but it's just, I think it's going to be a harder sell. You're going to have, I think the net impact is going to be fewer people saving. And so now you have fewer people saving. Those people are going to need some sort, at some point in time, people are going to need some sort of reprieve. And if you say you can only save for this much pre-tax and people stop saving, then down the road, when all those people go to retire and they're beyond working age, then what do we do? Right, then we're going to be right back here saying, okay, now we have a retirement crisis where we have, you know, 60 to 70 year old people who can't afford to live, and we're going to have to.
We see way too much of that already.
Well, we see it already, a lot worse, and then it's only going to get progressively worse as, you know, the baby boomers continue to retire, and even, you know, that generation after the baby boomers start to retire, and, you know, what do their retirement plans look like, and what are they going to look like moving forward? Now, again, this is only a proposal.
Right.
But
it's something where people need to pay attention to what's going on in government, because this will affect you.
Right. Now, and this was proposed by the GOP. This was proposed by the Republican Party. This is the party that's supposed to be taking care of people, right? Preaching fiscal responsibility, right? Pull yourself up by your bootstraps and all that other shit and save for the future and take personal responsibility. And, you know, they're incentivizing that very notion. You know, I mean, it's just like, well, we want you to save, but we're going to make it harder for you to do so. You know, like, you got to climb the mountain to financial independence, which, you know, if you do that, then you do it the right way. That proves that you know, our way is the right way. And so, oh, by the way, while you're doing that, we're just going to throw this oil, you know, down the side of the mountain that you're climbing up to make it that much harder.
Well, and the people that get affected by this disproportionately are lower middle class people.
I think the middle class. I think upper. I mean, I think that really this could really impact the upper middle class, right?
Yeah, I guess. What I'm saying is the likelihood that you're going to need, you know, if you're making $200K a year, and yeah, you're getting taxed on this extra money. All right, I'm thinking at retirement age, the people who are in the upper end are probably going to be in much better shape just because of the
I think no matter what, if you're on the higher end of the earning spectrum, you're going to be better off.
Right.
Either scenario.
I guess that's what I'm saying. It's hardly breaking news.
But, you know, the question is because I think the real issue you have now is how many people in your lower to middle class are actually saving at the rate that they should. Right now, as it is.
From what I understand, the numbers are not very encouraging. They're
not encouraging, right? Like, so, I mean, you've already got a building and pending crisis on your hands, and you may be you may be potentially making it a lot worse than what it's already going to be.
Yep. All right. One more thing we have to talk about, because this is so exciting for me in a weird way. They are going to release the remaining documents in the Smithsonian related to the JFK assassination. That is something that I don't know how many times we've talked about me and JFK conspiracies on the show.
I try to limit it.
I know you try hard, and you've usually been successful. I usually don't force that in as much as I'll force an occasional OJ talk. But I don't know what's going to come out, obviously. So maybe this ends up being much ado about nothing. But I'm very excited about what this could lead to.
So do you know the circumstances of the release? So everything, like, so all remaining documents that the government has, CIA, everybody,
right,
are going to be released unredacted.
That's right. So huge.
I mean, like, and the key part, everything to this point has been redacted to the point where they were pointless, they're useless. Now part of the issue is that because they're not going to go back and unredact what's already been redacted.
Right.
So there's still going to be gaps in information that you don't know. But there is a lot of information out there there potentially is a lot of information that can be released about who knew what and why. There's already, I mean, you're talking about the CIA, you're talking about the FBI, we're talking about potential potential motives from different groups. You had a potential war going on with, you had the Cold War going on with the Soviets. You had Castro down in Cuba. You had the Kennedys that are trying to, that may have been trying to get the mob to kill Castro. You had the military and, what did they want the Kennedys killed because of, Vietnam and every other thing. So,
well, and we talked in the beginning of the show about how the military has been used without particularly being clear about it on the surface to advance American financial interests. And lots of people, myself among them, believe that the military-industrial complex wanted a war in Vietnam because they had the budget, they had the toys, they wanted to get paid. And I think it's pretty clear that Kennedy was a risk to backing out of that. So not too long before that, we had the Korean conflict, as we never, well, we call that a war, actually. But, I think a lot of folks in position to lose a lot of money really wanted to make sure that war steamed forward. Kennedy was a risk to that, and lo and behold, he gets killed. The things that are going to be really interesting to me to find out are, what more do we find out about Lee Harvey Oswald and his military service, his going to Russia, coming back from Russia, things that have always been pretty gray. I want to know what went down around the assassination of Oswald and how, what more will we know about Jack Ruby and his role in this whole thing, because that opens a whole big can of worms. And this is a passion of mine since the Oliver Stone movie came out in 1992, actually well before that, but that movie really lit a fire under me. And when I realized how much shit they made up for that movie, when I had to realize that, it was so painful. I basically, Oliver Stone said, yeah, I made a bunch of shit up because I wanted to get you to think. I made you think. Good for me. I still love Oliver Stone as a director, but that movie has so many factual flaws in it, and it's so painful for me to have to come to that knowledge. But it's anyway.
Based loosely based on a true story.
Well, and another thing that doesn't get talked about often, but the movie is based largely on Jim Garrison prosecuting Clay Shaw. And when Jim Garrison prosecuted Clay Shaw, he knew damn well Clay Shaw had nothing to do with it. He wanted to bring the trial to him, but...
Do you know how many people have no idea who the fuck I'm talking about right now? Do you have any idea?
We were talking about Africa earlier today. They know more about JFK's assassination than they know about Africa.
I don't know if that's true.
All right. Well, now I'm going to bring up David Ferry and his role in the... And George de Morenshiel. Do you want to talk about George de Morenshiel?
No, stop. Stop. No, so, in truth, this, so, I have a huge interest in this. You know, I think I told you, you know, maybe it was last year or so. I was headed to Vegas a couple years ago. And before my flight, I'm waiting for the Uber ride. And I flip on the History Channel or something like that. And they actually did, it was a documentary on the... On the assassination, and it was, but it wasn't like your typical documentary. I mean, it was clip after clip after clip from the days before all the way to through, you know, Johnson, you know, being sworn in, and I was an emotional wreck. I couldn't deal. The only thing,
I do remember talking about
like
this.
The only thing that got me through it, I think was whiskey and the fact that Vegas. I was going to Vegas. I mean, I couldn't believe, there was a huge emotional impact because you look at how, you look at how he was beloved, and then you look at everything leading
how he was hated, too.
Well, yes, beloved and hated, and what was going on in the country at that time, you know, and just especially as a black person, you know, seeing all, just seeing, you know, when you see black people who saw Kennedy as, you know, as hope, kind of like people saw Obama. And then when you see that hope just snuffed out, you know, in an instant, and you see the dejection and you saw the raw emotion of where, what are we going to do? How are we going to get through this? That was our chance, right? That, you know, people who, you know, not just black people, but there were, you know, kids crying who really had no... Who could not even begin to understand the magnitude of what they were experiencing, but all they knew was that they liked Jack Kennedy. And then, you know, to see, you know, what happened with Jackie trying to, you know, scoop his head back. I mean, it was a mess. And it hit me emotionally. And even before that, I read as much as I could about it to get a better scope. And, you know, the conspiracy aspect of it loses me a little bit, but, I mean, you can't help but think that there was something else going on there. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see. Thursday is the deadline. So, I plan on Thursday putting, a little note up at work to my email, don't bug me, because I'll be at the archive website trying to download all, 60,000 files to figure out, what I can figure out about Kennedy being assassinated.
And I mean, if you look at the,
maybe we should post it on our website. No, this, we'll post a link somewhere in our website for people to go to the archives.
Write an article and link.
I feel like other nerds like you're gonna crash the site.
You're right, and I offer no apology for that. But in all seriousness, when you look at it from the impact to civil rights and to, Black America, I mean, the assassination of JFK is a huge blow to what hope they have. And 5 years later, Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King are gunned down again by mysterious lone assassins. I mean, that had to be absolutely draining.
Yep.
And I mean,
even Malcolm X too.
Even Malcolm X, but I think that was an internal fight. I don't think there was any conspiracy theory about what... It's not pretty well known that... it wasn't Nation of Islam's...
Yeah, but I mean, don't oversimplify that. Malcolm X had parted away from
the... Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. His name was Malik El-Shabazz at the time.
And so that, yeah,
okay.
I mean, that's a slight oversimplification, so you got to be careful with that because at you're talking about a point in time when he was making a transitional way.
True.
You know, he had gone and he had, you know, spoken out against
Elijah Muhammad.
Elijah Muhammad and everything else. And so you know,
okay.
There's a lot. I mean, I think all of that grouped together. And then it goes back to, I don't know, man. They're telling us that, you know, it's no big deal. Racism is gone. It's no systemic. It's, you know.
Well, that's what Ben Shapiro said when I was listening to him today, so it must be true.
Ben Shapiro.
Yeah, he's kind of a douchebag. All right. You ready to wrap this up? Yeah. All right. Hopefully I didn't depress you too much.
Me?
Yeah. Okay. All right.
I can't be depressed. I'm the happiest fucker you know.
Yeah, okay, there we go. Thank you for listening to Whiskey Congress. We'll be back soon with a new bottle of whiskey. Have a good night.